MU podcast in association with 7 Digital.
This week, the MPAA, Dr. Luke, illegal iTunes and Prince. I'm Andy Malt. I'm the editor of CMU, still in Edinburgh, but this time hopefully sounding a bit better because he's not on the phone, is Chris Cook, who is business editor of CMU. Chris, how do you sound?
I sound like this, so who knows how it will sound on the final podcast. But since last week, people may remember that last week's was what we're now calling the phone call edition of the CMU podcast. So I was sort of shouting down an occasionally crackly phone line. We now have the 3 weeks podcast suite set up in Edinburgh. Okay, so obviously I'm up here in Edinburgh because our sister publication, 3 weeks, covers the festival that happens here. There is a TW podcast that covers the festival. We now have the podcast suite set up, so I'm no longer relying on a phone. Although I should add, because I suspect that my voice will sound slightly different to your voice, that the TW podcast suite in Edinburgh is actually a cupboard in the flat that we take over for the month of August here in Edinburgh. So it's not quite as swish and, sound encased as the studio that you're currently sitting in London. So I suspect that I will have a bit more of an echo than you. But people who remember the old CMU podcast that we used to record on a sofa in a very small, hot, sticky meeting room in the middle of Shoreditch might get, a little bit of nostalgia from the way that my slightly echoey voice sounds. We'll see. Yeah. Maybe Matt can do something really clever on the edit that means that I shouldn't have said all of that, and it will just sound like we're sitting in one room in London and it's all perfect.
You didn't see the face Matt just pulled.
I trust him. I have confidence that this is going to sound like the most slick podcast ever.
Well, let's hope so. Despite last week not being quite up to the usual standards, we still got, I want to say thank you to people who rated and reviewed and shared the show last week. It seems that my constant pleas are sinking in. So I think that probably means that I should carry on really, really labouring that point and really, really, forcing people to sit through me going on and on about it at the start of every podcast. Pleased. It really does help get the show out to a wider audience. So it's very much appreciated.
Everyone who shared it last week was sharing an edition where people new to the podcast probably tuned in and said, why is that guy on a really crackly phone line for 45 minutes and they'll never tune in again?
Not true. They'll stick it out.
So people who shared last week will have to share again.
Yes. If you shared it last week, do share it again. In fact, every week. Just every week. As a matter of course. Share it with everyone because you're gonna have amazing conversations like the one we're going to have now about not Soper, but Soper by the back door. Soper and Peeper, in fact, sort of. This is a case in the US where the Motion Picture Association of America is attempting to, well, it's basically a test case, isn't it? They're attempting to get web blocking done in the US without new legislation. I'm sure listeners remember, we discussed this on the podcast when the podcast was recorded in a hot, sweaty room on a sofa. There was Soper and Peeper, which was two bits of legislation.
You were always very dismissive of the names because, of course, acts in Congress in Washington and America always seem to have much more dramatic names than bits of legislation considered here in the UK in Westminster, or I should say, because I'm in Scotland, also in Holyrood. Here we tend to have quite sort of sensible named acts, whereas in America they like a bit of drama in their proposed legislation. And so it was the Stop Online Piracy Act and the Protect Intellectual Property Act, abbreviated as SOPA. And did we ever work out whether it was Piper or Peeper?
I don't know if there was a consensus, but I think the Wired podcast said Peeper, so that's what we went with in the end. I vaguely remember. Just decided. I mean, they'll know.
So those bits of legislation were originally filed in Congress in Washington, I think it was 2011. And it was basically at a time when the record industry all over the world and the movie industry and other content industries were lobbying governments, asking them to introduce new anti-piracy legislation. So new rules that would help rights owners protect their rights online. And obviously here in the UK in 2010, we ended up with the Digital Economy Act that had the section which obliged internet service providers to send out warning letters to suspected file sharers. That never happened, but no. We did get the bit of law that was passed in Parliament.
It's still, I believe my prediction was that would never happen, and it still has never happened, so I'm winning that.
Although there was an announcement last year that it was going to happen sometime soon.
Yeah.
So that that's what happens here in the UK. The lobbying efforts in the US went less for the so-called free strikes, so the sending of warning letters to suspected file sharers with the threat of some sort of sanction if those people fail to stop infringing copyrights online. And they propose more of the web blocking thing, which ironically is what we've ended up with over here in the UK, even though that was rejected from the Digital Economy Act. It never actually ended up on the final draft of that legislation, although even though it wasn't passed in Parliament, just through the movie industry going to court and persuading a judge that this was already possible under existing copyright law, we have a web blocking system very much up and running here. In America, the movie industry tried to get Congress to pass this legislation that would have put specific system in place whereby movie studios and record companies could have gone to either the court or to a government agency, and they could have said, this website exists almost exclusively to enable and encourage people to infringe copyright. So, you know, the Pirate Bay is nearly always the first website to be blocked once these systems are put in place. And so therefore, you should force internet service providers to block access to those websites, to put up one of those pages so that when internet users type in thepiratebay.org or whatever it is now into their browser, they see a page that says, you ain't going here, it's been blocked because of copyright infringement. And so that is what the movie industry wanted Congress to pass, but it proved hugely controversial. And it's interesting, over here in the UK, because this wasn't, in the end, part of the Digital Economy Act, there wasn't really the opportunity for it to be so controversial. It was then sneaked through in the courts, and now it's pretty routine and isn't controversial really anymore. Lots of websites have been blocked. But when they tried to get it through Congress in 2011, 2012, it was massively controversial.
Yes, there was a huge protest against it. I'm sure everyone remembers the day that Wikipedia went dark. Brought journalism to its knees by blacking out all its pages.
Not CMU journalism, because we don't rely on Wikipedia to find out all of our top pop facts in our stories.
No, we just know it all.
Other cheap journalists who rely on Wikipedia, yeah, there was no English, just the English language Wikipedia, wasn't it? There was no access to the English language Wikipedia for 24 hours.
Yes, in protest against these two proposed acts, in which the protest and various other internet companies were involved, and eventually they were successful in having these bits of legislation thrown out. And as you say, but look, since then, web blocking has really become fairly routine. In the UK, it was discovered that they could do it through existing legislation. So the fact that the Digital Economy Act didn't include it, and then nothing in the Digital Economy Act has really happened, didn't matter because they could do web blocking through the courts as they were anyway. And then various other European countries have done it. Some places don't. So Australia recently introduced new laws in order to introduce it. But yeah, other countries like the UK have just gone, well, we can do this under current legislation. And that is what the MPAA is trying to test at the moment, whether the US can do it without any new laws. So it's got this case against MovieTube, which is a website that contains films presented without license.
And it's interesting that there was rumours last year that the MPAA had got their lawyers going through lots of sort of case law and sort of, you know, scouring all the principles of American copyright law to see whether or not they could do, like they did here in the UK, to go to court and say, we don't need Congress, we don't need SOPA, we don't need Piper. It's possible to go to court and say, this website is massively infringing copyright, it does so for commercial gain, it's the core objective of this website, that violates copyright rules, so therefore you, Mr. Judge, should try and shut this website down. And that is definitely possible under American copyright law and has happened. The reason why web blocking comes in is it's a jurisdiction point, really. One of the problems of going to court and saying this website infringes copyright, shut it down, is usually the website isn't based within the country where you're going to court. And, you know, American judges can, you know, order a website be shut down all they like, but if the website's not actually based within the jurisdiction of the United States, then actually there's a limited amount of what they can do. And that's how it came in the UK. There was that Newsbin, wasn't it? It was the website that they did the test case with, yeah, over here. And so the UK movie industry trade body went to court and said, OK, you've already said, Mr. Judge, that Newsbin infringes copyright. They've now shifted their operations somewhere else in Europe. There's nothing we can do or you can do to actually shut this website down. So the next solution is, well, just tell all ISPs to block access to it. And so that's what happened here. So the question is, can that happen in America too? Big tech don't want it to happen.
No, and there's been an amicus brief submitted to the New York court where this is happening, signed by various people, various companies, but the big names on it are Google, Facebook, Twitter, Tumblr and Yahoo, all getting in there saying this should not be allowed to happen. And I guess their protest is, as often as the case, is that they don't feel that internet service providers and other internet gateways, such as Google, etc., should be made to police the internet. Because obviously, as you say, web blocking isn't shutting down a website. It's forcing ISPs to block access to websites on a list of, you know, infringing websites. So as you said, the Pirate Bay is the one that is the normally first on that list.
And in this submission, you said, what, it was an amicus brief, is that what it's called?
That's correct.
And so basically that's when you're not actually a party to the litigation, but you submit a paper to court anyway because you say, well, although we're not party to this litigation, it impacts on us and we want our opinion heard. And there are various things that they've said in there, which is that the proposals the MPAA are putting forward as part of this litigation is far too wide-ranging. And then they're also saying, and anyway, when Congress considered this specifically 3 years ago, they said, no, we shouldn't do web blocking. And surely if Congress have said 3 years ago that we shouldn't do this, then it's not for the courts to now intervene and say, well, actually, you should do this. And I suppose that is one slight difference between the situation in the UK, because although our parliament decided not to put web blocking into the Digital Economy Act, it wasn't that they rejected it outright and said we should do free strikes first, so we should try the sort of the sending out letters thing that never happened. We should do that first, and then perhaps web blocking is something to consider down the line. So our parliament hadn't outright rejected web blocking in a way that I think you could argue Congress did. So perhaps that argument is stronger in America than it was in the similar situation over here.
Yes, although in this case, obviously, websites blacking out their pages did have an effect in the past. Actually submitting documents to a court on a case that they're not a part of, we'll see whether that has any effect on this case.
Or indeed, if they are planning, you know, another big campaign of the way we saw 3 years ago, are they that committed to this again or not? Or, you know, is it more that they're putting it their lawyers out there to try and stop it? Because what has happened in the 3 years?
It's more difficult in this case, though, to have that big campaign. Obviously, if it's proposed government legislation, that's something you can fight for and get people on side in the protest, which is what happened. You know, they got a lot of people on side in the protest against this. But actually, when it's a court case, that's sort of less easy to protest against.
Yeah, it is, yes, because I mean, I suppose a judge should not be swayed by that kind of public outcry in the way that legislators are obliged to be swayed to an extent. So you're right, it is a much trickier way of doing it, but it, you know, it will be interesting to see whether or not the courts are swayed by their arguments and whether or not we do start to see web blocking. And as I say, one thing that has changed in the 3 years since SOPA and Piper is, as you said, web blocking has become the norm in many countries, sometimes through a change in law, sometimes just through litigation. And certainly over here in the UK, it's no longer considered controversial when, you know, every 6 months a new set of web blocks come in. And I was at a conference in London a couple of months ago where there was actually a representative, a legal guy from Telefonica, an ISP, who was there basically saying, you know, of all the anti-piracy techniques, we think web blocking has been the best one. So actually there you've got an ISP big up web blocking rather than, you know, sort of trying to intervene and stop it. So it will be interesting to see, as we so often say on this podcast, how this turns out in court.
Yes, obviously an MPAA case against a movie website, not obviously music news to start off a podcast this week. However, it will have implications for all kinds of copyright infringing websites, but, you know, movies and music are always the key two in these things, and it will have a knock-on effect whichever way this court case goes for music as well as movies.
For certain, because if MPAA were to win, then what we can almost certainly expect, as indeed happened here in the UK, is that the Record Industries Trade Body will then be back in court soon after with a big long list of the websites that they would like to see blocked. I suppose the thing that we ought to mention before we wrap up this section is, although web blocking has become the norm over here, it's still very debatable as to how big an impact it has, because it doesn't take a great deal of web skills to go online and work out a way of accessing the Pirate Bay in the UK, even if your ISP is in theory blocking it under court injunction. And so critics of web blocking, less than perhaps they did back in the day, are saying, oh, well, this will be the end of the internet. It means legitimate websites will get blocked, because that hasn't come true. But they do continue to say the thing about web blocking is it doesn't actually work. And I suppose it's interesting that Google put their name to this submission to court, because what the European labels would like to start to see happening is not just ISPs blocking copyright infringing websites, but Google delisting them as well. Because one of the reasons why web blocks don't work in Europe is it's so easy to reach a blocked website with a very simple Google search. So if Google would play ball, web blockings are never going to be perfect. There's always going to be plenty of people who have the know-how to get past them. But if Google could be brought into this, well, that potentially would mean the web blocks would be much more effective. And, you know, that would become quite a powerful anti-piracy tactic. So Google don't want to get involved in that. But it's interesting, will MPAA add Google to their list of people to participate? And if they did, that could also have an impact over here in Europe, because I think the movie studios and the labels over here would follow suit.
More copyright infringement court cases now of a different kind.
There's been a lot of them this week, hasn't there?
Well, you know, there's always a lot of them. But this is quite a fun one, an interesting one.
This week in particular, there do seem to have been a lot. But this is the one we've chosen to focus on here in the podcast.
Yeah, because I think this is a very interesting case. So Dr. Luke, who is a producer of many a pop record, has been sued over a drum sample he used in, or allegedly used, I should say, allegedly, in Price Tag by Jesse J. It's a breakbeat. Should I explain what a breakbeat is to people now?
Yeah, do very quickly tell us what a breakbeat is.
So breakbeat is basically you take a record, you find a little bit of drums that has no other instruments playing on it, you sample that, you loop it, you create a new drum track. It's a basis of many, many thousands of tracks using old records to create new tracks. So hip hop is very, very prominent. A lot of like dance music, drum and bass, like old jungle is all based on basically what's known as the Amen break, which is from a 1969 track, Amen Brother, or Amen Brother by the Winstons. And it's just a little, like one loop of drums, and then you build it into new things. And it's a very common practice, but these samples are very rarely cleared. And that is what makes this case interesting. It's the use of a breakbeat, alleged use of a breakbeat called Zimbaku, from the track Zimbaku by Black Heat. It's a track from 1975. One of the writers of the track, Lenny Lee Goldsmith, is suing Dr. Luke through his company New Old Music Group, claiming that there are... I would say if you asked him in the pub, he would say, Dr. Luke ripped off a bit of my track. But because of the way these things work, he's saying there are similarities between his track and Dr. Luke's or Jesse J's, whoever you want to credit it to.
Sampling cases are always interesting. And I mean, they predominantly happen in the American courts, because I suppose, you know, the sampling is most prolific in hip hop, and the big hip hop releases, certainly the most valuable hip hop releases over the years have predominantly come from the US. But it is always that thing of, well, how much of a track do you have to sample before it's copyright infringement to not have permission? You know, is just a beat copyright infringement? And you know, some of the precedent that's been set in cases is you don't have to sample much at all for copyright infringement to apply. Even though, you know, what sometimes people say is, okay, I may have taken that little snap of that drum beat from that track and I've looped it and I've used it for my own thing. But I mean, it is just one tiny little bit of drum. It would have been really easy to just recreate it. It's just that I'm a producer and I chose not to. And so therefore, it's mad that that's copyright infringement. And it's also would be mad if this case was successful, because not only has Dr. Luke allegedly used this, but plenty of other producers have definitely used this same thing on a loop on their tracks, we almost certainly without permission.
It is a popular break. It's featured, you will have heard it on tracks by NWA, Eric B and Rakim, DJ Shadow, Chance the Rapper, Biz Markie, and many other hip-hop acts, and obviously pop with Jesse J. I'm not saying that Jesse J is a hip-hop act. I will stake that right now. What's interesting, as you say, like, you know, someone might argue that they could quite easily recreate that piece of drumming. In this case, Dr. Luke's legal team's argument is that, similar to the recent Blurred Lines defence, that it's not a straight rip-off, it's just a drum track that contains specific elements of a certain style of drumming. And so Dr. Luke's legal team asked for a summary judgment in the case, and that sort of backfired because the judge last week presiding over the case decided that it wasn't as easy as just saying, no, this there's similarities, but they're just stylistic, and recommended that it goes to jury trial, which is not, I assume, what they wanted.
So, no, we are going to have a, well, unless some sort of out-of-court settlement comes forward in the meantime, this will go to court, so it will be another sampling case, another copyright case, like Blurred Lines. And there are parallels to Blurred Lines. Obviously, Blurred Lines was not about just a drum beat. It was about many other things, too. But, you know, that this whole thing of, well, you know, is it not just a vibe, a feel? It's a kind of rhythm that you find in all sorts of music. How can any one person claim to own that? Because there are huge similarities between what they did and what we did. All of that laid on with another classic, you know, samples case. How much do you have to sample for copyright infringement to kick in? So it will be, you know, if it goes to court, you know, what arguments are put forward, who wins, and, you know, what impact does that have on all of the other records that have used this sample, maybe or maybe not with any sort of approval?
Well, yeah, I think that's it. If it does go to trial, it would be interesting to see how that affects the arguments, because, you know, if this little drum loop has been used in tracks for 20-odd years without any opposition, to suddenly say, well, it was in this big pop track and now I want paying, is that a valid argument after all this time? Or will it just look like, you know, someone trying to grab at some money? I mean, maybe, you know, sometimes that's enough of an argument.
So one of many interesting, genuinely interesting, yeah, really interesting copyright cases, all to do with really sort of tedious technicalities of copyright law, that's due to come up in the American courts in the next couple of years. So I'm sure if it does get to court, we will return to this one on a future podcast.
Massive bombshell news now, and iTunes is now illegal in the UK. I've read quite a lot about how I can't use iTunes anymore in the press in the last week or so. Chris, how are we going to deal with these shocking and troubling times?
There have been an awful lot of stories, haven't there, in the mainstream press to that effect in the last 7 days. It all began with a Torrent Freak story about the much previously discussed, I know that, we discussed it at length here on the podcast, the much previously discussed private copy exception, which was abolished in the High Court quite recently, resulting in the headlines that you're now seeing. I mean, the headlines were in the main nonsense. And to be fair, some of those articles, if you actually read the story, it was one of those where really bold headline, and then quite quickly into the story, I think most people would have said, yeah, that headline was nonsense.
As we know, people don't read headlines, so my Facebook wall has been quite interesting. Yeah, people discussing this story having only read the headline.
Yes, or maybe the first paragraph of the Daily Mail story. So basically, iTunes is no more or less illegal than it ever has been. So a quick recap on the private copy exception. It has always been, with the exception of a few months starting late last year, it has always been in the UK that if you take a CD that you have bought and you put it into your computer and you rip the tracks to iTunes and then you listen to them on your computer and you put them on your iPhone and so on and so forth, it has always been that that is copyright infringement, because there is no license with the CD to allow you to make additional copies, and in the UK there is no private copyright. So any ripping of tunes that you do today or have done ever since, you know, CD ripping became a thing. Do you remember there used to be a magazine all about CD ripping? What was that called?
Yeah, Rip and Burn.
Rip and Burn. So all way back to the days of Rip and Burn and all two issues of that magazine. Technically speaking,
I think there were three.
Were there three issues? Technically speaking, it has been illegal to make rips of tracks off CDs in this country. Just like it was illegal to do tape-to-tape copies, even if they were for your own private use. Now, in the vast majority of other countries, within copyright law, there's something that we call the private copy exception. And what that exception says is that once you've bought a CD, providing you bought it legitimately, you are allowed to rip tracks off it, providing it's for your own personal use. Okay, so it's not that you can make copies for your friends, but if it's just so you can have, you know, a copy in the car and a copy at home and you want it on your iPhone as well as on your computer, you're allowed to make those copies for private use under this exception in copyright law. Now, that exception has never existed in the UK, which is insane, because the truth is, it might be illegal to rip tracks off a CD, it might be copyright infringement, but no record company would ever sue you for that. And indeed, you know, when this was being discussed in Parliament quite a few years ago now, the BPI's representative at the time basically said that no label is ever going to sue you for copyright infringement for ripping a track off a CD. So it's mad that there's no private copy exception here. And to be fair to the record industry, pretty much everyone agrees that there should be a private copy exception in the UK, and so does Parliament. Parliament added a private copy exception. It became law last year, so there was a period of I don't know, 6-7 months when finally you could start making private copies of your CD collection without being a lawbreaker. However, although the music industry, and this is what we did discuss on the podcast the other week, although the music industry has no problem with the private copy exception, they have a problem with the way the UK introduced it. In most other European countries where the private copyright exists, there is also what we call a private copy levy. And traditionally, that was a bit of money was added onto every blank cassette sold and every blank CDR sold that was then passed normally to the collecting societies and redistributed to the music industry to compensate them for the fact that all these private copies of their music were being made. Here in the UK, the government decided not to include a private copy levy as part of the private copy exception, partly because what the hell do you add that levy to anymore? And that's been quite controversial elsewhere in Europe in recent years. But they said our private copy exception here in the UK is actually much narrower than the private copy exception elsewhere in Europe, so therefore they didn't think a levy was necessary. The record industry and the music industry did not agree. It went to court. It said this violates European copyright rules. The High Court agreed. The private copy exception was quashed. The government now has to have a rethink. What it means is, technically speaking, it's now illegal to rip CDs again, hence the Torrent Freak article, hence the Daily Mail article, hence all of the chatter in Andy Malt's Facebook timeline.
Yes, and not just the Daily Mail, but yes, the Daily Mail's article was a particularly incendiary one in terms of its headline. But this has been amazingly reported all over the place. Which, I mean, for one thing, it wasn't news. And then it's doubly not news because it's something that happened, you know, a couple of months ago now. And just, it's not news. It was already illegal.
And also, I mean, even aside from the fact that you know, it's only technically illegal to rip CDs because you're never going to be sued, and I assume the government will sort all of this out. Also, the headlines were saying iTunes is illegal, not just the CD ripping bit of iTunes, which, I mean, surely for most people, you know, okay, we know that the CDs are still being sold and lots of people are presumably still ripping those CDs. But, you know, for an ever-increasing number of users of iTunes and Apple's music services, they're not using it to rip CDs anymore. So you know, yes, very sweeping sensationalist headlines. Although, I would like to point out that we predicted that this sort of stuff would happen, because I'm of the opinion that the private copy levy, it's a tricky one, because in Europe, quite a lot of this money goes straight to musicians and straight to songwriters. It's not just feeding the major record companies, it is feeding music creators. So I understand why the MU, the Musicians Union, and the British Academy of Songwriters and Composers and Authors feel quite strongly about this. But it's, for me, it's really hard to justify to people why they should be paying a levy to make private copies. And we said at the time, you know, fighting the private copy because of the levy will just result in exactly these sorts of headlines, which just makes the music industry look like a bastard again, which means that when the music industry is then trying to get other copyright reform or trying to educate people to respect copyright, people are just going to turn around again and say, oh yeah, the money-grabbing music industry, screw you. So I think what we can take from all of these stupid stories is that we were right.
Yes. And that's basically why we're discussing it now, just to point out how right we were.
This is a new slot on the podcast called CMU Gloats. And tune in next week to see what we're gloating about from the developments in the music industry in the next 7 days.
This could be another Alan Partridge reference on the podcast. Just we'll have a section called Needless to Say, I Had the Last Laugh.
But in the meantime, you know, feel free to rip your CDs. You ain't going to get sued. And when you do get sued, yeah. I'll come and say in court what I just said and see if it helps you.
We should all go home and rip CDs in protest.
Let's all go and have a CD burning party.
Except I can't be. Ripping CDs was always a tedious thing. It's like, no one's doing that anymore. Let's just stream stuff and get on with our lives and shut up about levies.
Okay, well, you heard it, listeners. Shut up about levies.
Just time to have a quick look through some of the stories. It wasn't possible to have a proper detailed look at this week, but last week we spoke in depth about Beatport not paying labels. This week there has been some resolution to that, hasn't there, Chris?
Yes. It's important that we update on this because last week we left it hanging actually almost as soon as our last podcast had gone live on the website. Beatport then sent out a message to their labels and their distributors saying, you know how we said we weren't going to pay your royalties? Yeah, sorry about that. That was a mistake. We're going to pay you your royalties. We're really sorry. So labels seem to have accepted that. It was a temporary wobble, a bit of bad communication. And the boss of SFX, which of course owns Beatport, Robert Silliman, also issued a statement saying he was really embarrassed that this had happened, because of course the reason Beatport gave for not being able to pay the labels last week was that Silliman is trying to buy back SFX, you know, to buy the big chunk of the company he doesn't own, and that, you know, money had got caught up in this buyback process and that was why the labels weren't getting paid. Don't know where all of that came from, but, you know, as far as we're aware, the money is now flowing.
Yeah, after some negotiation with the Association for Electronic Music, which is still a fairly new trade body, so that was quite a coup for them as well. They come out of it looking quite good.
Nice for them to have a little bit of something to do.
Yes. Next, talking about a thing to do, Vivo wants Warner Music, because Vivo, which I don't think a lot of people, well, people do realise, obviously, but I saw some people discussing this week, and people don't realise that Warner is not part of Vivo. It's only Sony and Universal, and some independents. But Sony and Universal own it. Warner does not have a stake in Vivo, which I think people assume it does.
Yes, so of course Vivo provides a lot of the official video content from Sony and Universal for certain, and for a bunch of indie labels too, via YouTube. It was all set up back in the day when the major record companies were saying to YouTube, you should be getting more money with the advertising that you put around our videos, and YouTube said, well, we don't think we can, and so it was all sort of set up that the label said, well, through Vivo, we'll sell the advertising, and then we'll give you a cut rather than the other way round. So the big majors, Sony, Universal, and a bunch of indies, if you see their official videos on YouTube, they're actually coming to you from Vivo. That's why there's more advertising. That's why the ads are not skippable, because Vivo are trying to make more money. But Warner didn't want to be part of that party back in the day, and they actually had their own relationship with YouTube. So they were basically doing the same thing, but they were doing it as just Warner-branded official channels rather than doing it through a third-party company like Sony and Universal chose to do. But Vivo got a new boss recently, and seemingly he thinks it's important for them to have Warner Music within Vivo. And I suppose that's particularly important as Vivo tries to build itself beyond YouTube. So obviously you can go to Vivo.com, there are Vivo apps, which are nothing to do with YouTube. And I suppose there, on YouTube, it doesn't matter that Vivo doesn't have any Warner content, because the Warner content's there anyway, whereas on Vivo's own platforms, perhaps it is an issue, which is perhaps why the new boss of Vivo, apparently, is trying really hard to get Warner content in there.
You said there were various interesting copyright cases in court this week. This is one no longer in court, this Shakira plagiarism case, which has basically fallen apart.
It has. This is an interesting case that's been rumbling through the courts for some time. Shakira sampled a record on a track that she released quite a few years ago. Now, that was all fine. It was all cleared. It was all licensed. Actually, the guy behind the original that was sampled was actually performing on the record. But then another guy came forward and said, I wrote that song. So you may have done a deal with that guy, but he's not the guy. I wrote the song. And it was all in court last year. The guy making the claim that he was actually the songwriter and that his copyright had been infringed won last year. And what was meant to happen this time was they were back in court to assess damages. But Sony, as Shakira's publisher, arrived and said, oh, a crucial piece of evidence that guy presented last year, which was a cassette of him singing the song supposedly recorded in 1998. So the idea being he had access to this song years before everybody else did, turned out to be a fake. And so the judge said, that's basically fraud in court, I'm throwing this case out. So at the very last minute, Shakira and Sony saved themselves a lot of money by defeating that bit of litigation.
And another one, Jay-Z and Timbaland up in court on moral rights.
Yes, this is a moral rights case. It's another one that's been rumbling through the courts for years. It all relates to the Jay-Z track Big Pimpin', which Timbaland produced. There is a sample in there. It's a sample of a bit of music created by an Egyptian composer who is no longer alive. And the story goes that Timbaland cleared the sample with EMI back in the day, but then the family of the guy who had written the music came forward and said, oh, that deal with EMI wasn't valid. There were various reasons why they said that, but one was the argument that because Timbaland took the bit of music that he cleared but then sampled it and regurgitated it in a hip-hop record, that violated the moral rights of the original composer, and therefore whatever license may have been in place, whatever deal may have been in place, was invalid. The question is, do Egyptian moral rights have any weight in an American court? And legal reps for Jay-Z and Timbaland tried to have this case thrown out a few years ago by arguing, no, Egyptian moral rights do not have any power in the American courts. Judge allowed it to proceed. It's now due to reach court in October. And what we found out this week is that if it does get to court, Mr. Jay-Z and Mr. Timbaland are going to testify. So it could be another fun case to watch, like the Blurred Lines one earlier in the year.
That could be very exciting.
So a good test of whether or not foreign moral rights stand up in American court. I suspect they won't, but I guess we'll find out.
No, I don't think so. But here's a thing that's happening. RDO is going to bring radio into its mix.
Yes, the latest of the streaming services to say just having 30 million tracks isn't enough. We need to bring you more stuff. Although, unlike Apple, RDO are not proposing to make up their own radio station like Beats One. They've already have a partnership with one of the big US radio groups, Cumulus. And so basically they're going to pull that company's 500 of them, that company's AM and FM radio station. So you'll be able to listen to them through RDO and through the RDO app. This will just be US only for starters, but they're hoping to do similar deals with other radio stations around the world. So that you'd pay for audio and then listen to the radio, which presumably you could listen to it for free. I guess you'll be able to access radio stations that you wouldn't be able to get in your local area on AM and FM. But anyway, radio's coming to audio.
Yes, and live streams coming to Mixcloud. Or possibly,
yes.
I think. I don't think this is a definite
very
thing.
Much possibly. Yeah, the Mixcloud founders gave an interview to Music Ally. Mixcloud, of course, is a website where you can upload radio shows or podcasts or mixes. They have it licensed in a lot of countries, so you don't have to worry about getting licenses from labels and from publishers. And so there's lots of radio-style shows up on Mixcloud that contain music, including the CMU podcast, if you want to go and listen to that there. And in an interview with Music Ally this week, they said, we see ourselves as sort of, you know, the radio, on-demand radio of the internet, where we're sort of, you know, things like this and bedroom-produced radio shows can be. But you know what's great about radio? The live thing. And so we often think that we should add live to the Mixcloud platform, although it was clearly sort of a plan in the distance rather than something they're planning on launching next week.
Something it is launching this week, or has indeed launched, Google is no more. That was an overstatement. Google is now a
yes, you're
Google is no longer a parent company.
Competing with Daily Mail and their iTunes is now illegal headlines there. Yeah, Google have done a corporate restructure, so all the core bits of Google are still going to be part of a company called Google with services branded as Google. But then Google will be part of a bigger company called Alphabet Inc. And then some of the periphery businesses that Google have set up in recent years that aren't really anything to do with the main Google business, rather than being part of Google, will be standalone entities as part of Alphabet Inc. And I think that's all we need to say on that, otherwise we'll start dissecting why the hell they decided to call themselves Alphabet.
Well, it's before Apple and Amazon, isn't it, in the alphabet. Yeah, there you go. Let's just talk about the Spice Girls.
Yeah, you had a lot to say about the Spice Girls.
Tons. Well, they
given
had
that not,
they had a lot to
given
say.
Given that nothing is happening.
Or something. Basically, there might be another Spice Girls reunion, but there also might not be. Those are the two things that could happen. And they've been discussed at length in the last week. Mel B did some US TV interviews where she noted that the 20th anniversary of the band's formation is coming up and she would very much like to do another reunion tour. Then The Sun ran a story saying that they were going to go on a reunion tour, except Victoria Beckham is not going to be involved. And then Emma Bunton went on her radio show and said, well, I don't know anything about this. And then Mel C made a joke about it. That is basically, I wrote quite a long story. That is everything that story said. very quickly summed up.
So to conclude, the Spice Girls might be going on a reunion tour, or they might not be.
I think they probably are.
It's a story we could probably run every single week on the CMU podcast. But there you go. Let's do the final story of this edition.
Yes, how about it? Why don't we talk about Prince says that record deals are slavery. Now, we haven't skipped back to the late 90s. This is a thing that Prince is saying now, and he did indeed say then. Previously, when he had... in fact, he does have a record deal with Warner now, but a different one. When he was actively signed as a jobbing recording artist to Warner, he had a lot to say about being locked into his record deal. He subsequently, last year, signed a new deal with Warner, although that's more a catalogue deal to reissue his old albums. Prince has been in the news quite a lot lately because he's got an album coming out next month, it turns out, which he's going to release exclusively on Tidal, which is an interesting move. He recently pulled all his music off streaming services except Tidal, and then he released an exclusive track on Spotify, and everyone was confused.
Which was confusing.
Prince is a very confusing man, but he's this week he's being confusing by claiming that, indeed, record contracts are just like slavery. That's what he said.
So he was talking about record deals because of the Tidal deal, and sort of talking about a new option for artists like himself is to do an album and then go and do a deal with a Jay-Z. Do you remember he put out a record with the Mail on Sunday, didn't he? So he's used to putting out records in unusual ways, but he was saying this is a great new area. There are people like Jay-Z and Tidal out there that can help you get your music out there. You don't need to deal with record companies anymore. And then he went on to say, you know, his advice for new artists is don't work with those evil labels. But as is always the way when you've got big superstar established artists saying to little artists, to new artists, oh, labels are evil, don't touch them, it's like, well, that's all well and good if you're Prince, because of course if you're Prince there's plenty of people who are going to distribute your music. Of course Jay-Z is going to help you and put money on the table and do all the marketing, but you know, if you're just some unsigned band, well, you still need someone to spend some money, you need someone to do some marketing. And the truth is, obviously, Bandcamp, Music Glue, you can do a big chunk of it yourself, and that's great, and you should. But most new artists at some point that either need incredibly good, well-resourced management or probably a record deal. So record deals may be comparable to slavery. Clearly they're not, but they may be comparable to slavery. But, you know, it may well be that new artists are still obliged to do their stint in servitude in order to get their careers established.
No, and you get the same old argument of, you know, it's all well and good Prince coming out and saying, oh yeah, you shouldn't sign a record deal, record deals are slavery, and you know, fine, Prince fell out with his major record label and changed his name in an attempt to get out of his deal, but Prince still, as a new artist, signed up to a major record label deal, and that funded his subsequently very lucrative career. It's that ongoing problem of wealthy artists who've made their money from major record labels saying you shouldn't work with these companies.
So look at us defending record companies on the CMU podcast. How did we end up doing that? Clearly because it's August, we're not concentrating properly enough. And I'll make sure I come with a list of record company disses for next week's podcast so that we sort of over the month we balance things out.
Well, to be fair, I think like Prince did make some fair points. He was saying that they should, you know, you should show support for artists who are trying to do things themselves. And then, you know, once artists have built their own resources, they can do things. They can all do things for themselves. Although then, presumably, someone like Jay-Z will become essentially a major record company screw everyone else out of their money. So I don't think anything's going to change. You're always going to need someone to provide the tools and the finance. But I think it's just, I don't know. I don't know if people, I can't remember, I was quite young when he did this last time. I can't remember if people particularly called him out, but I think, you know, comparing people being forced to work against their will, possibly being trafficked to other countries and tortured, is comparable to willingly entering into a contract that you subsequently decide isn't quite for you. It's it's sort of, you know, it's not really like slavery, is it? Not at all.
No. In terms of sweeping statement throwaway quotes, it's what could perhaps be termed as a Morrisseyism. So I suppose Morrissey and Prince, in terms of making amusing but daft sweeping statements, they in that respect they do have something in common, don't they?
Yes, well, I'm not sure Prince has got anything on Morrissey. Maybe that's something we'll have to look into. Who said it best?
We can come back to that on a future podcast.
Speaking of future podcasts, you'll have to wait for a future podcast to hear more from us because this is the end. Oh, did you see that segue? But before we go, I just have to tell you again, please do subscribe to this podcast so that you can receive it automatically every week. You can get it straight into your ears without any effort on your part. We'll just be there for you. And then review us. Give us a really nice review and rate us. Oh, that would be very helpful. And then share the podcast on all your social networks and follow us on Twitter at CMU and Facebook, Complete Music Update. This edition of the CMU podcast, as all of them, was presented by me, Andy Malt, and Chris Cook. It was produced by Matt Peaty. And for more on CMU, go to CompleteMusicUpdate.com.
Recorded at Unique Facilities, the CMU podcast is an Unlimited production in association with 7 Digital.
Sorry, I've got a burp.
I think don't mention it now, but then just mention it in the ending bit.